assuming duty to conform to new rules. We need to provide job creators with certainty and a bit of clarity. This bill will allow them to focus on expanding their businesses, hire more workers, and become more competitive. With our state and nation slowly making a recovery, House File 2211 is really the relief we need to push job growth into the next level. House File 2211 provides a two-year pause for all state agency rulemaking that are given current rulemaking authority. In crafting this bill, we created a few common sense exemptions to this moratorium to give the state agencies the wiggle room that they need. In a good cause exemption, Chapter 1433.8, in times of serious immediate threat to public health, safety, and welfare, compliance with court order or requirement in federal law relating to incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, and also relating to changes that do not alter the sense, meaning, or the effect of the rule. This bill sends an instant message to job creators that we as a state are serious about making the state the best place to do business.
So. Okay, any questions for the author? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm still not clear on, is this for new rulemaking?
Yeah,
the rules that are in the process of being made would be allowed to be continued.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the bill will take effect beginning of July, so any rules that are completed prior to that point will just continue their normal path. Rules after that point would potentially be affected. So,
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I'm still not clear there. Say we were in this, an agency was in the second year of, toward the second year mm-hmm. of their rulemaking process of 2 years, that they were thinking that it would take 2 years. Would they have to stop then in July? Before they were completed, even though they had already put in a year of work on it?
Representative Switzinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think the process would potentially change. So instead of the rule simply being put in place, we would potentially work with the agency as a legislature, take those recommendations, put them into bill form, pass them as statute, and move forward. So it wouldn't necessarily be a pause. There would simply be another layer of reflection that we'd have within the legislative body.
Mr. Chair, Representative, would this then the laws that the information from the rulemaking that was gathered in the first year, then you would turn them into legislative bills for the next session that we're going into? To pass in 2013 session?
Representative Swiginski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is my belief.
Other questions? The author, we do have at least one person who has requested to testify.
If the first year's work would be gone, we wouldn't have the benefit of the first year's work.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. I guess what exactly is the definition of a rule? For example, I have a bill that would allow a set aside for a certain MPCA regulation, but you'd have to meet certain standards to get that set aside. Would that be considered a rule, and would that be part of this moratorium?
Representative Swiginski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, I think it really depends on, as you're creating a situation of a bill that you're writing to give certain to the MPCA depends on how focused the language is. So as we're given direction to the agency, it really I have Judge Littman that maybe could speak just on that portion of it as far as the focus that bill would have to have when it comes to giving liberty to the agency itself.
Mr. Chairman,
Judge Lippman.
Members of the committee, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge for Administrative Law at the Office of Administrative Hearings. The rule, there's a definition. It's in 14.02, Subdivision 4, and it would relate to executive branch agencies making a rule of law, not a statute. So I don't think that, well, I'm not familiar, Representative Moline, with your particular bill. I don't think that it would be encompassed by it, but if I could read the definition that's found in statute. A rule means every agency statement of general applicability and future effect, including amendments, suspensions, and repeals of rules, adopted to implement or make specific the law enforced or administered by that agency or to govern its organization and procedure. And so, again, the shorthand is when agencies make general statements of applicability, this is how the law will apply or this is how this statute will apply in this particular circumstance in a way that that governs, you know, public rights. And so, again, I don't think that the statute, because it's not an agency, it's not an executive branch agency that's making that rule. The legislature, you're convincing your colleagues to make that rule. Even though we're, in this context, rule is a term of art, which is, it refers to the lawmaking activities of executive branch agency. I hope that's clear.
Thank you. That's fine.
Okay. If not, we have... We have Mr. Mike Hickey that requested to testify. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Well, good morning. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities, with about 13,000 members statewide, and the largest small business group also. And I'm here today to support the bill. And I think... As mentioned, really the point of this bill is to try to take a time out on the burden of rules and regulations that have been just increasing over the last several decades around here, to try to give small business owners, farmers, and others some relief from the ongoing release and burden of these rules. What's occurred since about the 1960s is that there's been this broad delegation of power from the legislative branch to the executive branch. And an increasing number of bills are being passed that broadly delegate power to the executive branch. The best thing for this legislature, the Congress, or any other body is just quit doing that and to try to better write the laws themselves. But obviously, delegations of power are going to occur. But we've really seen a trend of it being significant over the last three decades. And this bill, or last four decades, this bill takes a time out on that. And we really appreciate that. It's there are so many rules out there right now. A lot of our membership isn't even aware of some of the rules that affect them because they don't have attorneys. They don't have anything. They have themselves. Their family-run businesses are very small businesses. And I think another thing legislators need to realize is that there's just a comprehension problem out there. A lot of people are not aware of the new rules that are coming online every year that affect their industry or affect their business. And a lot of times there's just not a comprehension occurring that one might think when you're sitting here in St. Paul being involved with the legislation and these issues. So I think it's a really good idea to take a time out on this. It certainly helps struggling people in the economy and not burden them any further. The one concern we do have with the bill, though, is get the bill in front of me. Was that taken out in the amendment?
Yeah, we've got so if you get specific things being in effect, so that's the text that are in the amendment version.
Yeah.
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 Okay. Mr. Chairman, I had not had a chance to see the amendment prior to this morning, but just to make a quick comment about the bill as introduced, line 1.14, clause 4. I just urge the author, the advocates, and appearance that's occurring to strike that. It just is too large of an exemption. It really goes against the spirit of the bill and what the bill is intending to accomplish. And hopefully that's getting done, although I can't do this quick of a read to tell you. But it sounds like the author wants to address that. But that was our one concern about line 1.14. And appreciate your support of this. And thanks for the chance to speak.
Representative Swedzinski. You don't have an amendment.
No, Mr. Chair, I do not have an amendment. Okay. I think we're working on two different pieces of paper here, so I think we'll continue to move forward and just double check that we're filling. We're looking at it. So
okay, Representative Gauthier, did you have a question of the testifier?
No, to the representative.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Representative, I don't understand if we do this moratorium and we pass legislation, how we implement law if we don't make rules to implement. So I'm kind of confused about that because we're going to pass a lot of laws this year. And so how do we move forward? Are we just going to have statutes on the book and not enforceable because we don't have a process of enforcement?
Representative Swierczynski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, it is my belief that this bill will simply ask the legislature to also set forth in statute, not just the law and the statute, but also work with the agency on how it will potentially be enforced and go through the rulemaking process with the state agency to much greater depth. Is that,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gauthier.
Representative, so your intent is to have the legislature be the rule maker and to use administrative powers? Is that what I'm understanding you say?
Representative Swierczynski.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative, it is my belief that the state legislature has been granted lawmaking, rulemaking authority by the voters. And we would simply be pulling some of those duties back into the legislature rather than delegating them to the state agencies with this process, with this bill.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swierczynski, as you know, we had a really good debate and discussion about this in the Government Operations Committee, and not to repeat too much of it, mm-hmm. I think that it is worth repeating, though, that administrative rules don't just spring up. We essentially indirectly create them in the legislature. We pass bills, and we explicitly give rulemaking authority very often to the agencies. So it's sort of a case of, stop me before I fill again kind of thing. I mean, we're the ones responsible in the legislature. So we can pare back, prune back, eliminate rules if we want to, particular rules. This, to me, is, I said it in the last committee, I think is well-intentioned. You mentioned in the last committee a particular constituent of yours, I think, who was having a problem with a particular rule. I don't doubt that that was a problem as you described it. Maybe it was overzealous. Maybe it's not even necessary. But the point is, do we want to sort of kill a housefly with a shotgun, and do we want to have an approach here that's an all-out freeze of all rules across any agency from agriculture to zoology and freeze out everything of any kind? It seems to me probably an overreaction in my judgment. And then my experience is both the same as yours and different than yours. I, of course, as I'm sure all of us have encountered constituents who have a problem with a particular rule or regulation that they think is burdensome and may be burdensome, but I've also encountered constituents, both business constituents and individuals, who want rulemaking to go forward. Businesses in particular who have campaigned for, in a sense, and pushed for certain rules because it does give them stability and certainty, as you mentioned. It does give them clarity, whether they're a cosmetologist or a therapist of some kind. Those are two examples in my district where they want certainty that the rulemaking process will bring to their profession. So I think it cuts both ways. And then the other thing worth repeating is some of the testimony we had in the Government Operations Committee. We had testimony from DNR folks who said that if this bill were to go through, they couldn't do interim kind of changes to hunting and fishing seasons. They couldn't do that. We had testimony from the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, Ken Peterson, who said they couldn't go forward with the new building code. And that could create a real problem for a lot of businesses who are in the construction industry. Wisconsin's going forward, and if we can't. So I guess the overall point is, I see where you're coming from with this bill. You had a constituent, or maybe just philosophically, generally, you feel that there are too many rules and regulations, and that may be, but I think we can pare those back and trim them back selectively rather than kind of a one-size-fits-all total ban approach. So I'm going to oppose the bill. I appreciate where you're coming from. I just think this is a bit too heavy-handed.
Representative Swierczynski, do you wish to respond to that?
Chair Lanning, Representative Smith, no, I appreciate your thoughts and your canter on that. I believe, as a legislature, there are many different bills, I think, that are working to address rulemaking within state agencies. There are many different modes in which that can happen. I agree that maybe this bill has the potential of looking at the direction, maybe to one side or the other. With that, I know I have spoken with the representatives from the DNR, Bob Meyer, I believe, and we've discussed it. It's not generally the intent to really go after the DNR's ability to set regulations within hunting seasons and fishing seasons, but we're looking at that. So,
Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want a little more clarification. Cool. Representative Hansen has had a bill about air standards in the ice rinks and there's been rulemaking going on for 2 years now. If that bill doesn't pass this year, then we're not going to be able to change the standards for 2 years? Is that understanding correct?
Representative Swiezinski.
Chair Lanning, Representative Murphy, I guess we'd have to have a conversation of exactly where that bill is at in development, and then also, where the process is at, and where the legislature could maybe potentially join in, and what, obviously, is it a group working group that he's looking to set forth, or?
Mr. Chair, representatives, it's a bill that I believe the rules or the results of the working group is before us, and it passed through Legacy Committee just 2 days ago. But I don't know that it's going to pass this year because I'm pretty much of a realist.
Okay. Well,
but the health department has spent 2 whole years. The legislature spent 1 whole session before that to get to the health department rulemaking. So that's 3 years invested in this, and all the hockey rinks across the state, over 200, are figuring out how they're going to have come to an agreement on these standards, and if by some chance that bill doesn't pass, then we're not going to make a safe place for little kids to skate for 2 more years in addition to that. Is that correct?
Representative Swiezinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't think if the bill happens to not pass during this session, we will be meeting again in January of next year. So it wouldn't potentially, we could still potentially take that bill up. So within, 6 months to 8 months of the conclusion of this session.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one more clarification, then I'll
Representative
stop.
Representative Murphy.
Representative Simon talked about DNR and hunting and fishing seasons, and so it's your intent that if this passes, then that the environment committees of the House and Senate will be discussing when hunting seasons should be for each licensure that they sell. Is that correct?
Representative Swiezinski.
Chair Lanning, Representative Murphy, it is, my intent with this bill to, I think when it comes to the DNR, that is not obviously, I stated before, the area in which we were focused on with this bill, but I think there is, if there is ability for us to create a game and fish bill that would encompass, certain rules that would allow, that would fit within this bill, but also allow them to, because of the unique things that the DNR does by setting limits during the season, that would potentially still encapsulate this bill, but also give them that room. I think that's something that we can be looking at within the Environment Committee. So, potentially, yes.
Representative Swiezinski, to this point, maybe to help get some clarification here, if your bill were to pass and be enacted into law, it would take effect on July 1.
Mm-hmm.
And would it then apply to any legislation passed before July 1 of this year, or would it only apply to legislation passed after July 1 of this year?
Chair Lanning, I'm going to ask Judge Lippman to help with that one.
Sure. What is he doing now?
Mr. Chairman, members, again, how I was reading House File 2211 as amended is that if there wasn't an order, there's a delegation of rulemaking authority from the legislature to a state agency, promulgate X rules, and if those rules were not adopted, if there wasn't an order of adoption by, you know, June 30, 2012, that there would be a moratorium in effect. An exception to that, as stated in the bill, would be if the legislature enacted those particular rules, because it always holds the delegation, and then told, as part of its enactment, told the DNR or whatever agency to enact the rules as stated in this bill. In that process, when we do those reviews now under the good cause exemption, as stated here on 1.16, Clause 3, relating to the incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, we compare the chapter law that's enacted by the legislature, you know, enact or promulgate these rules, with the revisor's draft of the rules, and if they don't exactly match, then the rules are defective. If they do match, they can be promulgated, you know, very closely match, they can be promulgated under this exception. As I was reading House File 2211, that's what I think Representative Swedinsky was trying to accomplish.
Mr. Shepard, can you help clarify this question? It seems to me that it may be obviously confusing about the effect of this legislation on anything passed this session or passed before July 1 of 2012. Can you help help us through this?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I do agree with Judge Lippman. I think this bill would prohibit rulemaking for 2 years regardless of when the legislation that authorized the rulemaking was enacted.
Okay. That helps make it
clear. Mr. Chairman, unless there was a notwithstanding provision, but assuming that in the ordinary course that you have until June 30, 2012 at midnight for the commissioner or other agency head to issue the order adopting the rules, which means all of the other processes before that's the last part of the process.
Okay, thank you. We have Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Swedinsky, I'm working to understand sort of the broader context of this. This looks to me like we're going to blow a whistle, signal timeout, take two years off from doing rulemaking. What happens in the meantime? Everyone goes to the bench and takes a rest. 2 years from now, we turn the switch back on. Has anything else happened to fix this process in that two-year period? Is there other legislation you see coming forward, maybe from you or somebody else, that fits with this two-year moratorium?
Representative Swedinsky.
Chair Lanning, Representative Banyan. I believe there are some other pieces of legislation out there. I think Representative Beard is carrying a piece that kind of maybe potentially sets a framework that would probably better engage the legislature and the agencies when it comes to the depth, when it comes to creating rules. I believe that I don't know for sure, but I believe that there are some other bills out there that would kind of potentially dovetail.
Representative Banyan.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Swedinsky. I find that helpful. I certainly think there's legitimacy to the concerns that Mr. Hickey presented, and I agree with some of them. I kind of feel that we need to have this done in the context of a broader discussion about what happens during the moratorium. thinking about this bill in isolation is a little bit difficult, but if we can somehow get that broader conversation, I think it's helpful for people to understand what House File 2211 tries to do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Loomer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to mention when Representative Murphy was talking about the bill having to do with the ICE arena. Now, Representative Swazinski, on Rule 1, or on line 113, mm-hmm. on the exemptions, when it says relating to a serious immediate threat to public health, safety, and welfare clause, would that apply then in that case, or no? I guess that was my question.
Representative Swazinski.
Chair Lanning, Representative, it really depends on what the exact situation was. If this was a simple regulation of potential ammonia or anhydrous or something that was used in the cooling system, and there was an immediate threat and danger, as maybe some units were exploding or something, potentially. But I think we're talking about the immediate public threat to safety, welfare. It would be my belief that would potentially be more into the range of if there happened to be a pandemic or some sort of a natural disaster, some immediate threat. Something going on with the CDC or whatever ability for our Department of Health to grab on to whatever happened to be going in that moment. If that was a product safety thing, I'm not sure if that would be, yeah. But I think that's maybe another point that I can make. It's also talking about, we talk about federal law. So there are many, just adhering to what's going on at the feds when it comes to rule changes there, that would also be exempt from this rulemaking. So you wouldn't have to do special legislation for that. We would allow the agencies to work to maintain those relationships that they're having with federal agencies when it comes to changes and some of those administrative things. So,
Representative Swazinski, I believe that Representative Hansen's bill relates to the problem of carbon monoxide buildup in ice arenas.
Okay.
Which it would seem to me that you could make a case that this clause on 114 would apply. That would be my interpretation as a non-lawyer.
Okay.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Swedensky. Hopefully I'm close. I'm sorry. Representative Erdahl suggested I do what Biskins does on the floor and call you a representative from Lyon County. So, if that works. No, a little bit down the line of what Representative Simon was saying, there's some, I think you're well-intended, and I certainly hope, but some of these problems that you're going to get into that have been mentioned with the DNR are just, I think you need to address as you move through with your bill, and I hope you do. Mm-hmm. There's also some problems. I'm on the Commerce Committee, and I just foresee some problems that you're going to have, and some of them have been kind of talked about just briefly. But, there's technical changes that come through federally. So just, some little change on insurance regulations or banking or something, some minor detail that so there's a potential that we could be a state that stands alone, an island, if you will, where all the other states do these little technical changes, make a change in a rule, and we don't. So I hope you're allowing for that, because that would be an unfortunate situation. Most of them aren't anything at all. They're just minor tweaks of, insurance experts would be really the only ones that are understanding of them. And I hope you're open to changing some of that as this bill goes through. I guess that's a question at this point, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski?
Chair Lanning or Representative Lilly, when it comes to, I think you're speaking specifically some Fed changes coming within the banking system, insurance rules, some of those umbrella organizations, umbrella rulemaking authorities that come down from the Feds from Washington. I think if you look at 1.14 relating to the compliance with court order or requirement in federal law, that potentially has the ability to capture those instances. where we're looking at federal agency rulemaking within banking. Obviously, state banks would potentially not get captured in that because I think we have some state regulations in those, but any other type banks, I think, would potentially get captured within that area. But I am open to having that conversation, Representative Lilly. So.
Okay, Mr. Chair,
Lilly.
And just kind of a final comment. I'm glad to hear that. And then, you know, I went to Luther College because all my siblings went to Gustavus, so I kind of blame Gustavus a little bit for this because I understand
brother,
that there's a Gustavus.
I would blame Gustavus, too.
the author in the Senate from Gustavus, right, if I'm not correct?
Yeah.
Is that the case? Someone's brother, maybe, perhaps?
Chair Lanning, Representative Lilly, I believe that... there is a particular representative that is represented in the Senate through relation. Yes, that may be carrying.
So I understand from the time that I spent in my youth at Gustavus that there's a game that they play at Gustavus that involves liquids that has no rules. It's called ninesies. So the game you play, the rules are kind of made up as you play the game. And... So this kind of seems like a game that I think we could blame it on Gustavus because the author, being a Gustavus grad in the Senate, must have came up with this idea and just kind of make up rules as you go, perhaps.
I won't ask you to respond to that. Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the Senate author is really popular in my district. So I don't know, Gustavus graduate or not. So we like him over there. I just have a question. You know, this is really interesting. Representative Downey has this bill to pay for performance bonds, and they appointed an oversight committee, and the oversight committee met the other day under the leadership of Commissioner Showalter. And as you know, one of the things we talked about was rulemaking, is to have those performance bonds work to get the appropriation bonds in place. We're going to need rulemaking, if not... expedited rulemaking authority. However, there is a lawsuit in place. Now, maybe we had session in the middle of all this, so we didn't get all the way through it, but there's a lawsuit in place. We have to wait till the lawsuit is settled till it's clear on how to get the pay-for-performance bonds rulemaking in place. So ideally, or potentially, Representative Downey's bill could be caught, and there would be no rules for the pay-for-performance bonds. Which I would see that would be a big problem, you know, potentially, because July 1st, I don't know if we can really get the rules in place for that. And as you all know, it is a very innovative bill. It's a very innovative idea. But there's no rules around it. And we rarely, what we learned at the committee, do things like appropriation bonds. So there's a lot of questions about it. So, Representative Swedinsky, what would you do for something like that? Is would Representative Downey's bill, the performance bonds would just be stalled for 2 years? Is that what would happen?
Representative Swedinsky.
Chair Lanning, it is my belief that there would be potential for some hangouts with that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lawler.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, something that's, it's a unique bill with, would need a unique set of rules on it. I think Representative Downey wants to comment on that. And I mean, that was what I heard out of that discussion, is there's definitely have to be rules, if not expedited rules, but they take a while. I mean, this is February, and if that goes effect in July, and Steve Rothschild is on that committee, there's several other people, but I think that's a big concern.
Since Representative Downey was brought in on that, I will let him respond as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a potential side benefit of the Swedinsky bill is that agencies and other commissions such as this might actually convene earlier, get their work done in a more expedited fashion so that in advance of the upcoming legislative session, were there any rulemaking considerations that needed to be adopted by the legislature, that could be done. And, for example, the commission that we're talking about, I think the original intent, and I don't know that we specified a date certain for the convening of the commission, but clearly the convening of this commission was delayed, you know, almost 6 months before we even met for the first time. so hopefully under this moratorium there might be a greater sense of urgency to actually convene and do these things, and the agencies might contemplate what rulemaking they want the legislature to come up with in the next session a little quicker, as compared to just dragging along and incrementally doing things at their pace.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I have a couple of things to say about this, but that last statement was really kind of puzzling. I heard someone say that that this bill is so great, so we're going to pass it, and for something that he really worked on, his recommendation is that they work really fast to get around the bill before it takes effect. Now, if that wasn't what I heard, I can be corrected afterwards. But I just want to call members of the committee, to a section of statute 3.841, which is deals with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and right under it is 3.842, which is a review of rules by commission or committee, and which gives a whole section on objections to rules and what the process is for doing that. Now, you know, I know I've served in this body longer than anyone else here, so it might not be a fair question, but I would like to know, and I assume that there are some members of this committee who are going to vote for this bill, and I would like to know if any member of this committee who is going to vote for this bill has ever looked at that section or used that process, or the author, and has any opinion on how that process works. And then I'll say something about, of course, you know, I have used it, and I actually used it somewhat successfully. I didn't get a rule written exactly the way I wanted, but I, you know, modifications that accomplished what I wanted got written into the rule. So that's just my question. Anyone who's intending to vote for this bill, have they ever looked at that, used that section of law, or attempted to use that section of law unsatisfactorily? And I believe I used it under the conditions when my caucus was in the minority, so it didn't even depend on having, you know, you just had to make a logical argument. And talk about the importance of the rule. The importance of the rule was the, and I know Representative Lilly at least will understand how important this is, that was the issue of the continuity of the rumble strips that were putting in, being put in on highways and their effect on bicyclists. So that's just for background. It's not important. But any rule, you don't have, doesn't have to be that. Has anyone who's going to vote for this bill ever tried to use this section and have any experience with it?
Representative Swodzinski, do you want to Chair respond Lanning, to that?
Chair Lanning, Representative Kahn, I think why I have specifically not in my short time here had an opportunity to dive into that particular piece.
But you're an expert on rules anyway.
Well, I don't.
Okay. All right.
I wouldn't say
all
that.
Right.
But we did have some testimony in the last committee that talked about rulemaking and then how that affected and how many rules that they had had reversed or changed, and that number was extremely small.
I'm just
if that.
Yeah. Well, Mr.
particularly
Kim,
goes.
I'm just saying my experience was only one, and the answer was it was one for one, even though
okay.
it wasn't
okay.
done exactly the way I wanted it to be done. It was better than it was before I got into the process. So, you know, I think I don't know how you would have found out how many times that's been done, but obviously nobody here has any experience with it. So.
I haven't seen anyone jump up in response to that question here. So, Representative Simon, and then we need to move on. We've got a couple more testifiers, and then we've got another bill we need to get to as well. So, Representative Simon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be quick. I actually appreciate what Representative Downey was saying about, hey, maybe this can speed things up a little bit, and we know that a lot in state government could stand some speeding up. But I do note that on line 1.19, it says the effective date is the day following final enactment. And so assuming this goes to Commerce, and then from Commerce it goes maybe to the floor, you know, it could be ready for the, and then we have floor debate. I think this could be enacted. If the governor were to sign this, it could be enacted in a matter of a couple, 2-3 weeks. That seems pretty darn fast. I don't know if people can get their work done that quickly, either on Representative Downey's bill or others. And then the other thing I think worth noting, members, is not only do we have the power not to delegate rulemaking authority because we're the ones who do it, we're the ones who create it, but Section 14.126 of Minnesota statute says committee authority over rule adoption. Subdivision 1 says if the standing committee of the House of Representatives and the standing committee of the Senate with jurisdiction over the subject matter of a proposed rule both vote to advise an agency that a proposed rule should not be adopted as proposed, the agency may not adopt the rule until the legislature adjourns the annual legislative session that began after the vote of the committees, and then it goes on to talk about more more in the way of process. The point is, I think we already have tools on a selective basis, whether it's your constituent or other people that we encounter. We have the tools to rein in particular rules that are duplicative or burdensome or somehow offensive to us. I just don't know that a two-year, all-purpose, one-size-fits-all policy of freezing all rulemaking from agriculture to zoology is really what we want to do here. I think there are a lot more surgical ways to go about it.
We have a couple of others who wanted to testify. I see one stepped out temporarily, but Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I know you did talk briefly about the impact this bill would have on hunting and fishing seasons, but we establish all of our hunting and fishing seasons through special rulemaking authority in Chapter 84. The language as amended in government operations still does not allow that. Number 3 on 1.16 is specifically just a restatement of the good cause exemption, and we would need to have reinstated some specific statutory authority to do those hunting and fishing seasons, or the legislature would have to take it upon itself to pass those packages into law. What we do on an annual basis is establish population harvest levels for bear, moose, deer, zones, which are very, very complicated, meets and bounds, roadway descriptions, things like that. We also have emergency rulemaking authority to manage the fish harvest on Lake Mille Lacs mid-season based upon a court order, treaty settlement agreement that we have. We would not be able to do that as well. So there are some severe impacts to the department at that level. In addition, the bill will not allow good rules to move forward as well. The administration at this time is looking at, as we all are, how do we make government better, faster? How do we create more jobs? Electronic pull tabs for a football stadium, if there were rules need to be made for that, we wouldn't be able to do that unless there was a specific good cause exemption. Things like that are just some of the unintended consequences of the bill. And I just want to specifically, I handed out a letter from Governor Dayton last year. It was on a different but related topic, talking about legislative approval of rules, and also a letter from Governor Pawlenty dated May 27th of 2003 on the same topic. And Representative Kahn brings up a great, great point, and Governor Dayton brought it up in his letter last year, the bottom of the first page. Currently, the legislature has the authority to change or amend an existing rule through legislation. Existing law, which allows a legislator to essentially override any rule passed by an agency, would seem to provide ample protections against overly burdensome or unnecessary rules. We review our rules on an annual basis and repeal those that are not needed or are not necessary. And then we justify the ones that we have. I can provide that information to members if they're needed. I also want to bring to your attention on the second page of the Governor Dayton letter, just the last sentence. I will strongly safeguard the long-established principles of executive agency rulemaking and regulatory authority. These activities are very important to an efficient and effective government, and a two-year moratorium will prevent us from being effective and efficient and dealing with the challenges and the issues that may come up that none of us are aware of. So, Mr. Chairman, those are the comments I have to make, and thank you.
Representative Erdahl, did you have a question for the testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does the representative from Lyon County have any ideas for how to address former Commissioner Meyer's problems with the hunting seasons?
Representative Swidzinski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I've been in talks with the current chair of the Environment Committee, and we're moving forward. So we're looking at a few different ideas of potentially how we could craft a game and fish bill that would specifically, trying to negate and negotiate the issues of on-the-fly rulemaking within the DNR. But we're working on those.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meyer, how many rules does the DNR usually do in a year?
Mr. Chairman, members, I have just a list of the expedited rules that we have. The DNR has special rulemaking authority in Chapter 84 that's unlike many other agencies, but we do rules relating to waterfowl seasons, deer seasons, chronic wasting disease, bovine tuberculosis, ciscos and smelt as bait, youth hunting opportunities for deer, wild turkeys, waterfowl, disabled hunters. A wolf season, we're asking for rules on a wolf season. I mentioned the Mille Lacs Lake. We need to do rulemaking to stay in compliance with federal court orders regarding trapping of Canadian lynx in the northeastern Minnesota area. Rules on fishing contests, commercial fishing on Lake Superior. Rules concerning special northern pike lake limits, southeast trout and border water harvesting. Amending our permanent wildlife rules. Rules on state parks, recreation, waysides, campgrounds, and trails. Rules on endangered, threatened, and special concerned species. So that's just some of the rules that we do on an annual or somewhat annual, biannual basis that we review and update.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr.
Members, could we please have people pay attention to...
Yeah, I'm asking questions here. So you're saying a couple dozen rules, maybe a year, a dozen? When do you usually have them done, before the end of session, or you do them during the interim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, it really varies. Our hunting and fishing packages usually go out, I think, in June or July, probably. We have a docket. On our website, we have our rulemaking docket that's up to date, and I can actually send a link to the committee if you're interested, and you can see all of our rulemaking activity and the timelines that are associated with those.
All right, thanks.
Okay, quickly, and then we can move on. Representative Lilly.
Maybe Mr. Byers could tell how the wolf season might work. No, I mean, because the rulemaking is appropriate to that because it could be on the fly. So I was at something the other day that kind of explained how that would work. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, that is a good point, because what we're asking for right now is authority within the Game and Fish Bill carried by Representative Hackbarth to give us some rulemaking authority related to wolf season establishment. And because of the endangered species post-listing agreement we have with the federal government, we need to be very cautious as we move forward. So we're talking about certain parameters of numbers and times of year to harvest those animals this year, but next year will be completely different, and the following year will probably be completely different after that as we learn and understand how people want to participate, their success rates, and things like that. That's really the reason why the department has that specific authority to manage the population within control of the biological conservation carrying capacity of the land that we have. So rather than come to the legislature every year and spend a lot of time in the Environment Committee debating how many moose or deer per square mile we should or shouldn't have and what those boundaries should look like or where the firearms zone should be versus the shotgun zone, the legislature has empowered us to be able to do that in consultation and coordination with the legislature through the rulemaking process.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. John Rutkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Rutkowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Cam Peterson. Some of you did hear his comments the other day. So in the interest of brevity, I will try to be as brief as I can. It's going to be hard to follow the DNR rulemaking because ours are a little more pedestrian but extremely important to especially the healthcare industry in the area of workers' compensation and in the area of the building and construction industry in which we regulate. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I want to give you about five examples of rulemaking that would be affected by this moratorium. Two of them have to do with medical fee schedules. We do an annual update of our medical fee schedules every October. We use four conversion factors to establish reimbursement for providers for more than 8,000 medical services provided by healthcare providers to injured workers. As I said, it's annually adjusted October 1st. Likewise, a rule requires that the fees paid to independent medical examiners be adjusted in the same manner as the conversion factors. A failure to amend these are required by law, and it will mean that many health care providers will not be able to increase their fees to meet their own higher costs. Because of the rule, amendments are required by statute but do not fall under this good cause exemption. And failure to amend these rules will almost certainly result in litigation to the department. So I bring that one up especially because the representative wants to have this moratorium to help businesses and to grow jobs, but I'm trying to give you some examples of unintended negative impacts on business in the healthcare industry. We'd also have to adjust our diagnostic codes, or we wouldn't be able to adjust our diagnostic codes, which we also do every October. So that would throw the healthcare community into chaos as far as which codes to use when they're providing people with certain medical procedures. Healthcare providers would argue that these rules are obsolete and need not be followed, and this would result in confusion and, again, potential litigation, which would be a cost borne by the taxpayers. Shifting gears real quickly to the building code, Representative Simon brought that up. We are right in the midst of adopting the 2012 building code for the state of Minnesota. It has not been adopted for 6 years. Wisconsin has updated theirs, so that would provide a competitive disadvantage to the construction industry if the building code process comes to a halt. A two-year delay in updating the building code will mean the contractors and others in the industry would lag behind the rest of the nation in terms of building design, materials, equipment, and training. And finally, Mr. Chairman, the Plumbing Board, this legislature enacted the Plumbing Board and the High Pressure Piping Board and the Board of Electricity in 2008. The plumbing code hasn't been updated since then. Currently, it is in the process of updating the code to reflect changes reflected by the regulated parties and other interested parties. The building code, the plumbing board and the high pressure piping board and the board of electricity, I may add, are made up of private citizens. These are individuals, not bureaucrats, who are asking for these rulemaking. I want to make that very clear that our rulemaking gets input from the private sector. These would be stopped, and I think for health and safety purposes, both the high-pressure piping rulemaking would come to a halt, and so would the plumbing code, and I'll stop and take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Rakowski?
Thank you.
Representative Murphy had a question about fiscal note.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The first one, the legislature one, based on the testimony that I've heard this morning, that if this goes on, we are going to have a revised legislature fiscal impact, fiscal note, because what we're doing by passing this bill or moving this bill on is creating 201 rulemakers. And of each individual legislator is going to need more help than what we already have. And what Commissioner Myers stated, that they're not going to be allowed to do, and that the committees are going to be doing, is going to create enormous amounts of new communication from our constituents, which is a good thing. But we're going to have to respond to those people that want changes or don't want changes. What day is fishing? Is Mother's Day going to be the fishing day opener? We are going to be discussing that on a daily basis for weeks and weeks and weeks. And our three people to an LA or two people to an LA and not having proper research staff to carry out the technicalities of the rulemaking is going to generate a need for more employees for the legislature, and I want that reflected in the fiscal note, please.
Members, if you look on the first section A here, it says the intent of the legislature in enacting this section to provide for a stable and predictable regulatory environment for businesses in this state by instituting a temporary rulemaking moratorium. But then following that, it sort of opens it up to the whole everything else, including DNR and whatnot. And I think that creates some problems and issues here. Since this the whole intent of this, as stated in the bill, is to provide some relief to businesses in the state, which is something we need to do, I think this needs to go to Commerce so that we can get Commerce's take on this. But members, I'm going to ask then for the bill to come back here, and maybe in the interim we need a little more reflection about the impact on of this bill on other areas, other problems that there may be. So that's going to be my motion, that we'll send it to Commerce, give them a chance to weigh in on this, which is intended to provide regulatory relief for businesses, but then I want it to come back to this committee. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, shouldn't this, I can't think of a committee that this bill shouldn't go to, because almost every single committee at the legislature deals with an agency that does rulemaking and it affects their substantive area. So I don't know why it should go to Commerce but not go to HHS or not go to K-12 or not go to the Jobs Committee or any other. I can't actually, I guess it has to go to Rules too. So I can't think of a committee this shouldn't go to.
Well, you can make that argument, Representative Winkler, and that's why I wanted to come back here, so we can have this issue resolved before this bill moves any further. And depending on what happens when it comes back here, it may have to go to other committees as well. Point well taken. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on this? If not, I will renew the motion that House File 2211 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Commerce, and we will tell Commerce we want the bill back after they've had a chance to hear it. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you.
Representative Downey. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1954 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could, as I bring the bill before the committee, if I could also at this point move the A1 amendment.
You want to explain the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of you heard this bill in State Government Operations Committee. For those who didn't, the intention is to provide a very straightforward and clean presentation of local government information. And the term that we used in the original drafting of the bill is a term called object codes, and object codes are actually a feature of local government accounting systems with the way they structure their chart of accounts. And I know it created a little bit of confusion in what I heard in prior testimony and questions. The intent of the bill is not to ask every local government to conform to some kind of standard chart of account structure, but to actually just roll up and aggregate kind of commonly understood expenditure types and report on those to the public as compared to the detailed chart of account object code terminology. And so what I'm doing to make that clear is replacing in every place where the word object code appears the word expenditure type. And then, Mr. Chair, another concern that was raised, and I want to thank the MLC for bringing this to me and strategizing a little bit how we could get around this. The provision under Section 275
that requires the kind of decision making on overall levies and budgets in the September timeframe actually refers to an overall levy and an overall budget, and most units of government haven't actually figured out the exact expenditure and program breakdowns for their formal or their entire budget when they certify their levy or send their levy information on in September. And so this section in the amendment line 1-4 to 1-9 basically says they at least need to report the total information on the budget. If they can't provide the breakdowns, then they, you know, they can do the breakdowns to the extent as is possible and reasonable, but they don't have to. They just have to report the total. So with that, I'd move the A1.
Representative Downey, Mr. Shepard, I understand, has a technical clarification for the amendment. Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, in putting this amendment together, I missed one reference on the object code that Representative Downey mentioned on page 6, line 5 in the headnote. Should delete the words object code and insert expenditure type.
You wish to incorporate that into your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. This amendment, the A1 amendment, is offered by the author to get the bill in the shape that he prefers. Any question? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief in my description of the bill. I know there's some folks that want to speak to it, and then we can come back and have more discussion later. Essentially, the purpose of this bill is to provide a very straightforward, very clean, easy-to-understand presentation of a city's or county's budget to the taxpayers before an election as compared to after, and in a way that an average person can readily understand it. And right now we have a truth in taxation process that I think many of us agree is not working extremely well. It doesn't have the benefit to the local unit of government and the benefit to the citizens that I think we would have anticipated or hoped. And part of that is because citizens, as they look at the information they get, really have no idea what is driving the costs or driving the program budgets in their local unit of government. The budget documents and the materials that are presented are probably pretty coherent to a city finance director or somebody who is schooled in these things, or maybe even a city or council person or a county board member, but not to the average person. And so these truth in taxation hearings are poorly attended. The information is dense. Citizens don't really feel like their comments are going to make any difference because it's after the election and after the budget is largely done anyway. And so this proposed solution is to just provide a very simple, straightforward, citizen-centric, spreadsheet graphic type presentation that the legislative auditor would prescribe that very cleanly tells the story of what's happening in the local unit of government, both in terms of the programs that are being funded and the program areas that are being funded and the increases or decreases in those areas across a period of years, and in terms of the cost drivers, the actual expense categories that are driving the cost increases, to very cleanly see that. And I know there's been some discussion about how much effort this would take and how complicated it would be. I took, I think maybe it was 20 minutes this morning, and just produced a sample of what I might envision, and I passed that around so people can see, I think, what is envisioned by the bill. And obviously we're empowering the legislative auditor to implement some kind of a standard format here. But this is intended to be very straightforward, very easy for the citizen and for the local unit of government to present. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd stand for immediate questions, and then we can get to the testifiers as well.
First questions of the author, and then we have a list of people who wish to testify on the bill. Any questions from the committee for the author at this point? If not, the people who have contacted us in advance are Kay Rackow. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NIAP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association. We represent the owners and managers of commercial real estate, as along with all of the tenants, of thousands of tenants that are in the buildings that we own and manage. And the issue that galvanized NIOP's public policy efforts in the middle 80s was business property taxes. Because of actions of a number of different levels of government, more and more of the property tax burden was deliberately shifted to business properties. And so since then, our focus has remained on defending the business property taxpayer, and most of our efforts have been at the state level. However, over the last few years, we started to hear some things from our members. One is some of our property managers started to say to me, I know that we're working hard to defend increases on proposed increases in the state general tax, but locally our taxes are going up. Isn't there something you can do about that? We also started to hear from leadership, members of our public policy committee, et cetera, that said, they said things like, we need to get at the spending side of things. We need to understand what is driving the cost and the need for additional revenue on a local level. So they ultimately said, put together a task force, get smart about this, come back, and let us know what the cost drivers are and make some recommendations. So we did. We put together a task force of about 15 of our members, ordinary citizens, and we spent a huge amount of time getting smart on Minnesota's complicated property tax system, as well as the complicated interrelationship between the financial relationship between the state and local units of government. We listened to mayors, city council members, county commissioners, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties. We talked with House Research. We had legislators out, labor negotiators. We spent a huge amount of time working on this. And we definitely and are aware of the multiple sources of non-tax revenue, property tax revenue, and the impact of their increases or decreases on local budgets, as well as the ultimate property tax levy. However, we determined that ultimately spending is the most important piece of the property tax system, and in many ways, as Representative Downey said, it's the most challenging for taxpayers to understand. And this became especially clear when we started to look at local budgets. We thought we could go look at the budgets and it would be very easy for us to understand what the cost drivers were. The way local budgets are organized is they're organized by function. So when a budget is presented to the public, you can understand very easily how much is spent on public safety, how much is spent on administration, how much is spent on public works, how much is spent on economic development, etc. And that's presented in a very good fashion and very easy to understand. When you really start to dig into some of the local budgets, you see that underneath each one of these program areas, there can be incredible amount of detail of expenditure type or object code. Some city budgets have 30 or 40 different categories underneath each program. Some have very few, and they're lumped together. But the one thing that we weren't able to find any place except for one county, and that is having those expenditure types aggregated across all program areas and presented as part of the budget. So we came to the conclusion that what we would like to see is some of those expenditure codes aggregated across the budget. So in addition to the very helpful way of presenting budgets, typically by program area, as a complement to that, we would like to see some of those object codes aggregated and presented as well, and that, along with trend lines, will give the taxpayer a complete story of the local budgets. I was at a conference at the University of Minnesota a little over a year ago, and I sat in on a presentation that was made by the Humphrey Institute at the request of the League of Minnesota Cities. And I walked out of there with some startling information. Three things the report came out with. One, cities will be broke by 2015. Number two, by 2025, all cities will have a 33% budget deficit. And they stress that something needs to be done. In addition, the report also says that city expenditures are anticipated to rise by 5% per year through the year 2025. So as taxpayers, this League of Minnesota Cities is telling us that our cities are in trouble, and we think it's extremely important to understand what is driving these costs so that we can better work with our local officials to address those problems. So I just want to make two or three points before I turn the mic over to the next testifier. This is not a replacement or a substitute for traditional program-based budgeting. It is a complement to that. It is in addition to that. It is not designed to force comparisons between jurisdictions. This is designed for taxpayers within a jurisdiction to understand what's going on and work with their local officials to figure out the best way to address whatever the budget problems are. And lastly, it is not meant to be a be-all and end-all of property tax understanding. In our opinion, this is just the beginning. So I thank you so much for your time and attention.
Thank you. Representative Winkler, was your question for the testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Rocco, first, just an observation, which is that under the NIAP proposal you handed out, under the second section, the fourth bullet point down, the proposal will allow citizens and the media to make comparisons between communities across the state. So it seems like that is one of the goals. But the question I have from that struck me from your comments is that you said that you concluded that spending is the more complicated side of the property tax question and the more important driver to look at. Yet you also said that the property tax system in Minnesota is extremely complicated. You're talking about two different things. It's very different to talk about the source of revenue, which is property taxes and state aid, fiscal disparities, and other non-tax revenue that cities have. That's far more complicated in understanding whether employee health care benefits are getting more expensive or pension costs are going up or whether parks are getting increases while police are getting decreases. I actually think the property tax, which is the revenue side, is far more complicated. So the question I would have for you as a representative of NIAP is, would you support amending Representative Downey's bill to include the sources of revenue and the amounts of revenue so that we can get a trend line and a comparison across cities so we can understand if the city of Crystal sent a letter. So see if the city of Crystal is getting more or less money through fiscal disparities, LGA, local property tax dollars, other sources of revenue, and compare that to the city of Golden Valley, where I live, and better understand those things. Do you think it would be a good idea to amend the bill to include the revenue side as well?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Reichel.
Representative, first of all, the piece that you have in front of you was put together before we spent some time talking with cities and counties, and we dropped the comparison thing immediately because of the strong resistance we got to that. So we are no longer advocating that. In answer to your second question, quite frankly, the first go-around on a possible proposed legislation did include sources of revenue. We think that's extremely important, but I would be willing to talk to Representative Downey about that, but what we tried to do was make the bill as simple as possible. But I think it's important to understand all of the sources of revenue, and some county people have actually suggested that one of the things we begin to that we would include would be fees, so everybody understands what's going on with fees. So I can't speak for Representative Downey, only for myself, and we would be willing to talk about that.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Rock, I would, this isn't going to be true everywhere, but the overall trend line statewide will show that the percentage of the city's budget that comes from state aid is going to decrease, and the percentage of the city's budget that comes from local property taxes and fees is going to increase substantially. I'm not sure if Representative Downey wants that data to be readily available or not. But it seems to me that if we're going to be, the bill as drafted focuses heavily on employees. And given a lot of the other discussion and bills we've had in this legislature in the last 2 days, that just strikes me as trying to put the thumb on the scale of policy analysis of what's driving property taxes in the state. And if we want a fair and balanced picture, we need to understand how revenue sources have changed. And I hope, and maybe Representative Downey can answer whether or not we can include that kind of detailed information about sources of revenue for local units of government in this kind of reporting.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to consider that. I think the bill is focused on the areas where there's probably a deficit. in coherent information, and most of the financial reporting that I look at actually does a pretty decent job on the revenue side of it. It's the spending side where things are typically kind of buried by program area deep down in the appendix. So I'm glad to talk about that. The hope is not to create more work than we need here. The focus, I think, of my bill is on the spending side, and so we'd be expanding the scope of the bill. I'm certainly willing to discuss it, but it wasn't the original intent of the legislation.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, we had, if I could ask members to turn to the colored handout that we have that was passed out, and if you look on page 3 and compare slides 5 and 6, you'll see that the only differences highlighted in this report or this presentation, the only differences between current reporting types and the desired reporting types is a detailed breakout of employee costs, supplies, and purchase services. Otherwise, they're basically the same. So that's a little contrary to the handout provided by Representative Downey at the beginning of the committee. But I guess the point is that I'm not sure that I buy the premise that it's so much more complicated to understand the expenditures now, and this bill would really create a much better picture, whereas on the revenue side, it's much clearer. I just think those are kind of unsupported statements, and I think contrary to the presentation that NIOP distributed here. So I do think, Representative Downey, that if we're doing this transparency in good faith, we should not just focus on employees, but also focus on the full picture, including revenue. And I guess, you know, maybe in keeping with the spirit of Governor Dayton's speech last night, if there's actually an interest in providing object data and being fair and objective about the trends in property taxes, we could actually get a bill passed and signed. But if it's just a focus on employees, then that looks like something else.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler, actually, the reason I quickly punched out that spreadsheet that I handed out was because your comments in the previous committee, I didn't understand them. And when I went and looked at the spreadsheets that you were referring to, I saw what you were talking about, and I think, I don't want to speak for NIOP, but I think maybe there was just a replication of slides and maybe the row headings weren't updated. And I think the bill as it's written is more accurately reflected in the handout that I gave you that I think kind of clearly delineates the difference between a program area reporting and the expenditure type reporting. So I think the intent is to do something that's workable and viable and pretty straightforward. And so I echo your comments in terms of trying to work together to come up with something that we could actually get passed.
Thank you, Ms. Reichow. And next, Sue Iverson. Ms. O'Rourke.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I might introduce the City Finance Director I have in today. Her name is Sue Iverson. She is the Finance Director for the City of Arden Hills and participates in one of the committees that, I don't think I introduced myself. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities. We're the statewide association representing cities here. But Sue actually participates in one of our policy groups called Improving Fiscal Futures, which helps us with our legislative platform that we bring forward every year. I think it was at our third meeting this summer that we actually had NIOP and the Minnesota Taxpayers Association come in and sort of explain the proposal that we thought they might be coming forward with in legislation. And I believe we had a really good back and forth, if you will, on their bill, their proposal, and just kind of the nuts and bolts and how things shake out in the finance departments. Sue can speak to a lot of those points, but I just wanted to bring up one or two concerns that I think are within your purview as a state government committee for this bill and its implementation. And if you will, Mr. Chair, if the final section of this bill deals with the Office of State Auditor and the implementation or the enforcement, if you will, of who's reporting what out there. I believe I'm correct in this in my discussions with the state auditor's office and others, the penalty section that's outlined there is a little bit different than some of the other LGA or MSA funds, how those penalties take place if, say, a city doesn't complete their TIF reports or their budget reports with the state auditor's office. If you think about it this way, as far as those reports go, the state auditor has a database, if you will. They can easily check off whether a city has completed those. I don't know that this bill actually lays out, I don't know that the state auditor's office is going to have a handle on cities' reports, if you will, on this information. And I would just urge you to keep that in mind as you move this bill forward. And perhaps Ms. Iverson can comment on that more.
Ms. Iverson, welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Sue Iverson. I'm the finance director for the City of Arden Hills. I am active in both the national and the state Government Finance Officers Association. I'm also a budget reviewer for the GFOA, so I review budgets around the state of Minnesota and nationally. And I also teach and train on budgeting and fund accounting. I teach the clerks and I teach for the government finance officers. There's 150 cities in Minnesota, about, and this affects about 225. Many of us use the GFOA's best practices, and we receive the GFOA's Distinguished Budget Award. So the objective of that program is to prepare a comprehensive document that's easily understood by the average individual. It describes city issues. It deals with their strategic plans, their organization, their financial policies, the organization, how it works. It serves as a policy document, a financial document, an operations document, and a communication document, and is not meant to be technical. Those usually are put together and done after the budget is adopted. Although when we do our budget process, we do put summary data together by expenditure category, and we give it to the council in the categories. It's in all of our council packets, and it's discussed at work sessions. And so the public has access to it on our websites and in a public document, and they know when those meetings are scheduled. Now, to look at the bill, when I look at the bill, if you look at Section 3, and you get into Subsection 3, the electronic budget information, the one thing I notice in there is they want to publish 4 years of budget data, but I don't know what 4 years of budget data does to you, because normally we have 2 years of actual. We have the current year budget, we have current year actual, and then we have the next year's budget. So I don't know if that was their intent, but this will put a lot of extra data, and I don't know what that budget data from the previous years is going to get you, because it's really actual data that you want to look at. 6 months, if the reporting deadlines that they have set in here, 6 months of data is really what we're working on. I do not get from the county or the state of Minnesota until the third week of August the information on fiscal disparities, what are LGA, those type of things are. So by the time we can have a meaningful meeting with our city council, it's about the last week of August, we have to have certification done by September 15th, so it's the first meeting in September that we can even do it. So we're usually adopting our budgets in a summary level, and it's just that. It's the revenue that we're waiting for to find out how we can then to figure out what our expenditures are. So we many times are working after that deadline in October and November trying to come up after we know what we've set for our budget, what we can do for the rest of the expenditure levels. And it also does not give meaningful, we have some concern that if you put this in a state report, like now the state auditor has a report on actuals and it's a per capita report. Many times if you want to look at cities and compare a like city to yourself across, you come up with data that's not apples to apples because we don't all operate the same way. For example, if you would compare Arden Hills to the city of Roseville, you're going to find that we have combined services. So we have contracted services for IT, for all our public safety, fire and police, and for our engineering. So those costs are not going to come under salaries and benefits. It's all going to be in the line item of other services and charges, where when you look at a city of Roseville, they're going to have a lot of costs under salaries and benefits and things for those type of departments. So you can't really meaningful look at our salary and employment numbers, where if you looked at a program level, all of our public safety costs are fire and our police. If you looked at those across, we would have those in a program level that would be more meaningful. When you look at subsection 3 and D, which would be on page, the forms and reporting requirements, we already provide the state auditor all of these categories, but it's due January 31st, and that's just because we don't have that data because of the timing that it takes us to get things. So the only thing that we don't do is we don't break down employee costs, divide into wages, salaries, pensions, Social Security, health care, and other benefits. So I don't really know what good that breakdown goes, because we do have ours broken down by personal services. You might be better off looking at total FTEs. I know that when we get people who come to our public hearings, they're asking us, have we added any new employees? Well, when you look at new employees, many cities, and I've worked in a city of 350, 3,100, and also in 10,000. I don't have a public works employee who just works in the general fund or special revenue fund. They're spread across enterprise funds, and my own salary is not just in a general fund or enterprise fund.
Ms. Iverson, we've got several other people who want. Please wrap it up.
Yep. And on subsection 4 at the publications, we feel that's an unfunded mandate because it can be very costly. Some of us have websites, but if we're using GovOffice, we have only a certain amount of information that we can put out there. And if we have to add a number of years' data in there, it's going to cause us to have to maybe pay for more storage, or it can be very costly. So some cities may not, that could be a burden. And then in here it has that with counties, they might have to also publish it in another city, in another newspaper. It gets very costly already with us even having to publish summary data and our financial report. So with that, if there's any questions.
Representative Gauthier, was your question about the testifier?
No, Mr. Chairman. It's okay. For representatives, so I'll wait.
Okay, if you could wait. Thank you, Ms. Iverson. Next, Cindy Geis. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Geis. I am the Scott County Auditor Treasurer, and I also manage the property and customer services areas functions of the county. We have 7 different departments that report up through me, all of them which deal with the public directly on a day-to-day basis. First off, I'm here to say on behalf of our county, we encourage truth in budgeting. We encourage data to go out to our constituents, our taxpayers, our readers. So this bill provides some of a mandate to cities and counties to say continue to push that information forward. There are portions of this bill that seem to cause us some distress, and so I'll hit on those just real briefly. But before I get to those, I would like to thank the authors of the amendment to this bill, because it really does allow for us to give us some flexibility, particularly with the proposed budget and having to be able to report that data on a budget basis rather than a fund basis, because we aren't down to that detail yet. So from my first testimony on Tuesday, I appreciate the amendment. It was very welcome. But just I'll try to be very brief here, just a couple of the areas that I want to touch on. Our county has gone through major reorganizations over the course of the last 5 years. We've eliminated entire divisions, we've eliminated entire departments, and we've merged services with other counties and our business partners such as the tribe, the cities, so on and so forth. So from a budgeting perspective, we have a comparative data from year to year that isn't real representative of 1 year to the next. We try to do things more efficiently and more effectively for our citizens. We go out and we have town hall meetings. We have citizen surveys. And our motto at Scott County is to deliver what matters to our citizens and to provide them the data that they're looking for in an effective, very understandable way that they can come back to us and say, how can you influence the budget process? And you tell us where you would like us to change the budget. If you want some expansion to a road, it's going to have some cost, so where do we cut in order to pay for that? So we really do go out to our taxpayers and ask for that information, and we try to provide it to them in a manner that's going to be most effective for them. The one part of this that I don't see is that there's not a whole lot of input from the citizens on this. There's some from the business side, from associations, from state and local agencies. But our day-to-day citizens who come to us on a day-to-day basis, they don't have a whole lot of influence in this process. So my recommendation would be to have the local governments have town hall meetings with their citizens and establish a basis to which they want to see and a format to which they want presented to them to make it understandable, rather than having a mandate come down from a state or state agency that is unfunded and that may cause some distress to our local units of government. So other than that, I will stand for any questions if you have any. I thank you very much for your time, and look forward to watching this as it progresses throughout the session.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Geis, you mentioned several different ways that you were getting this information out to the public through town hall meetings and through Truth and Taxation, different things you're doing. What kind of participation are you getting from the people in Scott County? Are they coming to these meetings? Are there large groups? Is it? I mean, so many of these things, it seems like we have two people show up, and it's the same two every year. Are we adding value here, or what? You know, what's happening with it?
Ms. Geis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murray, we do get some participation. You know, sometimes it really depends upon the location of our town hall meeting. In our highly ag areas, depending upon the time of year or maybe even the time of day that we hold these meetings, it may be difficult for our farmers to get in there. We are generally going through in the summer because we want to have as much information as possible as we start our conversations regarding the budget and where we want to go for the next year. Well, we all know that the spring and summer are very difficult times for farmers and rural communities to come to meetings. The last thing that they really want to do after a full day of work is to sit in a town hall meeting and talk about budget. So we try to get information out in other venues, whether it be citizen surveys where they can complete it on their own, whether it would be phone calls or offering a phone number to them to say, please call us, we want to hear from you. This is what we're proposing, we want to get your feedback. So in those rural communities, it's a little bit less attended. In some of our larger cities, we can get upwards of 100-150 people to attend, which in our county, we have 125,000, that's our population. So, you know, it really depends upon the day and the time and the economy. When we do this and the economy is strong and taxes are holding fairly flat, our values are rising, then we don't get as much participation. But as values go down and taxes go up, we seem to get a little bit more angst amongst our taxpayers when they attend some of these meetings.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Geis. And next on the list is John Thorson. And we have one more person, so we ask both of you to make it brief, if you would, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thorson, go ahead.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson with AFSCME Council 5, and I'm here today to express concerns similar that have been addressed previously by representatives of the cities, counties, and units of government about this bill. To echo some of the discussion that in yesterday's committee hearing and today's, we believe that this information is duplicative in reporting. There is a burden of reporting right now for local units of government. The staff time involved spent on reporting for cities, I know for sure, upwards of 15 different financial reports to various levels of government, and not spent on other service delivery. I think focusing on the expenditure side doesn't account for the inputs that drive those expenditures. There is the complicated area of aids, credits, fiscal disparities as one piece of it, but there's another piece that drives expenditures, and particularly with counties, and that's the human services need. You know, expenditures match need, and that and this reporting of data doesn't allow for that. I'd like to also express concern on subdivision 5, line 719, the penalty section for not complying with this is severe. You lose your aid. I'd contrast this with I guess, more of a carrot than a stick approach of the piece that was passed in the 2010 tax bill, asking for performance measurements. When cities and counties got together, developed some performance measurements for citizen information, and the carrot there was relief from levy limits rather than a stick of removing funding necessary to provide services. So again, I wish to echo the concern of the employers we partner with in delivering services in local government and ask you to oppose this bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Thorson. Then John Kay. I'm sorry, I wasn't sure how to pronounce your name. If you would do it for us, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is John Kiselishin.
Okay.
A-Y-S-Y-L-Y-Z-Y.
No vowels.
Yes, no vowels.
I will ask everybody here to repeat that shortly.
Thank you.
Please, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I served as mayor of Roseville from 2000 to 2004, and I've been involved in city government for the past 15 years. I've observed 11 annual budgets, participated in two as an elected member, and managed two more budgets as an elected member. I also spent 3 years serving on the League of Minnesota Cities Policy Committee. Now, I was not asked by anybody to testify here today. I'm not a registered lobbyist. I just routinely follow legislation and have a personal interest in this issue. I believe this bill would set reasonable and basic standards for the reporting of information. Now, the question is this proposal an administrative burden? In my opinion, no. Government should already be tracking this information for benchmarking purposes. I would suspect that in many cases the law would not increase reporting practices, but simply change and organize them. Now, on the issue of cost, in my opinion, providing information to the public in a democracy always comes at a cost. It's a cost of doing business. I can tell you that I personally own software that could easily do the reports that are being asked, and from my experience, and I've got a lot of experience in this area of websites, if you're paying more than $5 a month for a website, you are probably paying too much. Now, the concern of the timing of the reporting requirements. In my opinion, if you can't come up with the information that's being asked of here by September, from my experience, how can you have an informed budget discussion? When I ran the budget process in Roseville, we started our budget process in March, and we knew the levy amount by May. The council set the budget process. We established the levy, and then we started the process. You can't start the budget process, in my opinion, until you have a good feel of the members about what you're willing to set the levy at. Another point in Roseville here is that they've even talked about going to a two-year budget process, which is something they do in Washington State. Now, are the comparisons going to be 100% perfect from government to government? Absolutely not. And I don't see this proposal as having that as a goal. What I see it as is moving us in a direction of having basic information that lets citizens and elected officials do a rough apples-to-apples comparison of the basic functions of government. I mean, you cannot have a discussion about what it costs to run a fire department in Roseville versus New Hope if you don't even know how much money is even being spent in the first place. And as a former elected official, during my time in office, I would have greatly appreciated a uniform process. 4 years' worth of history is reasonable. On some budgetary issues, when I was mayor, I asked for 20 years' worth of history to have a good understanding of how things were working. I see this process similar to your fiscal note process, where you have a universal form that is applied across the board, so it's easy to understand. Now, some have testified that this proposal doesn't require enough information to address issues like, for example, a shared fire department. But as I read the proposal, this is setting a minimum of what information must be provided. If your city or county has a special situation, I don't see anything here that would prohibit them from adding a footnote and adding additional information. Now, is this an unfunded mandate? In my opinion, no, absolutely not. No one has to buy a new accounting system to prepare simple charts and graphs. I believe government already has this information in order to operate. It's a step forward. Change is difficult, but change is needed. I think government can do better, and this is a good framework. I don't see this as any more of a mandate than asking your city police departments to enforce the .08 law when that was passed. Now, somebody raised the question is, if this information is already available, why not have people just request it? Well, in response, why should I, as a citizen, have to write out 20 information requests to 20 different cities to, for example, compare the cost of police services? Because from my personal experience, I'll tell you what would happen if I did that. Five of the departments wouldn't even respond. I'd have to write them again. Some of them would require fees in advance, some by check, some by cash. Some would make me pay in person. Some would make me pay via mail. The 20 different systems. So I don't think this is a reasonable expectation for the public. And to conclude, I'll say that I support this bill because it's simple, uniform, easy to read information for elected officials and citizens. I mean, Roseville already publishes similar information, but we need it in one uniform format. And as I said before, cities or counties can add additional information to the recommendations, to the reporting requirements that are being proposed. So I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kaiselin and former mayor. We're out of time today, and we have a couple of people that wanted a couple questions, but members, I wanted to tell you where we're at with this bill. The Tax Committee has requested to see this bill, and so the motion that Representative Downey made was to refer it to them. I've indicated to the author, Representative Downey, that I want to see the bill back here again, so we will refer it to tax. I want it to come back here. I've also indicated to Representative Downey and local government representative that this bill has a goal of improved transparency, something I think all of us want. We want our taxpayers, our citizens, well informed. That's also been a goal of Truth in Taxation. And my experience has been Truth in Taxation doesn't work the way it was intended. And so I would really like to see there be some dialogue here now with representatives of local governments. They've been concerned about truth and taxation. Representative Downey brings a legitimate concern that the business community and others have with regard to local governments and their spending patterns. And I think we need to have some examination here about whether or not we need to make some adjustments in our truth and taxation procedures to achieve the same objective. So with that, quickly, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, being a former city councilor, I just have a couple of quick questions for you. When posting on this, are we talking about general funds or are we talking about special groupings of funds, like we own a public utility, does that have to be posted? Do pass-through funds from the federal and state government have to be posted? Those are just some questions that spring to mind right away. And how detailed do those have to be?
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, on page 6, line 27, it specifies the funds that are to be included, and the intention of the bill is that to include all funds other than enterprise funds, which tend to be kind of support funds to the other funds, and fiduciary funds, which would be assets and trust and things like that.
So the utility wouldn't have to be on there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, I'm sorry, so the utility would have to be on there?
Wouldn't.
Mr. Chair, I don't understand the interaction of a utility fund relative to this bill, so that's something we might want to clarify. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the City of Duluth owns the gas company.
Yep.
It's a public utility. Would that have to be posted their budget? Because we separated it out of the general fund.
Mr. Chair, President Gauthier, my understanding of what you described and the language of the bill is yes, it would be included.
Okay, and then I just have one other I guess it's a concern I have, and then we can be done and we can vote, I guess, if, unless there's other people. The penalties for noncompliance are pretty severe, and I guess part of my concern for that, and I guess I'm confused, is, you know, I've heard all last year, local control, local control, local control, and now we're saying if you don't do what we want, we're going to take your aid away. So that troubles me in light of administration's position on such things as LGA. Why we would, I guess I see this as circumventing something that we've already debated and discussed and compromised on last session, that LGA was going to exist, and now we have a bill that says if you don't comply, you're going to lose it.
Representative Gauthier, I've already indicated the bill is going to come back here, and you will have another opportunity to ask those questions. Representative Simon? Representative Downey, you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd renew my motion to pass House File 1954 as amended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
And as I indicated, I will ask the Tax Committee to send it back here. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Members, meeting adjourned.